Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, we talk about the phenomenon known as pandemic brain, distracted and overwhelmed since COVID first appeared. You're not alone. Also, fewer songbirds seem to be succumbing to a mystery illness which sickened and killed many this summer. We'll have the latest. But to start, the state of New Jersey is once again trying to resolve the long impasse over off-roading in the Pinelands. Conservationists accuse off-road drivers of destroying fragile natural sites in the forest, while the off-road lobby says many drivers are law-abiding and those at fault ride their ATVs and pickup trucks through sensitive areas illegally. It's been tough to negotiate detente. 6 years ago, the State Department of Environmental Protection published a motorized access plan, which would have effectively reduced the number of trails open to off-roaders in Wharton State Forest. But the so-called map was quickly dropped, apparently after considerable pushback from the off-road community. More recently, the DEP has completely shut down a number of areas to all users, including birders and hikers, and says it will publish new rules on off-roading while holding public hearings this summer. We've invited DEP Commissioner Sean LaTourette to join us to give us a sense as to any progress being made, and he's here with us now. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you and good morning. So happy to be here with you this morning.
Well, we're glad to have you with us. This has been, as you know, such a tough nut to crack. Let's tackle the conservation aspect first. Environmentalists say a lot of damage can be and has been done, particularly in ecologically sensitive areas. Is this your perspective, and what are we at risk of losing in the Pinelands?
So they're not wrong. I'll put it that way. Our friends across the conservationist community within our environmental non-governmental organizations like the Conservation Foundation or the Nature Conservancy, the Pinelands Preservation Alliance, for example, they have deep concern for the health and well-being of our Pinelands, which covers an extreme amount of land area in New Jersey, some of which is governed by the Department of Environmental Protection, because we operate our state parks and wildlife management areas, and we oversee our state forests. But a large amount of that area is also privately owned. Mm-hmm. What I can say about the area that is under state stewardship is that there are a number of features throughout Wharton State Forest, for example, that have been degraded because of rampant off-road vehicle use. But there's also an important perspective to keep in mind here, which is that every member of the public has a right to use and enjoy our natural resources. And we don't all use and enjoy those natural resources in the same way, right? We have birders, we have hikers, we have off-road vehicle users. And those who use our resources widely, that stay on marked roads, that don't drive through sensitive wetland habitat, those folks shouldn't be penalized and put in a situation where they cannot enjoy what are their resources too.
So but we have. Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say. So you're saying that off-roading can be done so it doesn't disturb ecologically sensitive areas.
Yes, and I would venture that off-road enthusiasts, those who make a sport out of off-roading, and it's not just a wild time treading through the forest, those who really practice that sport and engage in competition, they're mindful most often of the areas that they can use and enjoy. They don't want to see these natural areas be degraded. There's always, of course, a few bad apples in the bunch, or those who may just be getting to know a natural resource and aren't sure where they should go and not go. And we in the state government have to make that apparent. And that is why we need to pursue these vehicle mapping exercises so that folks know where they can and cannot go.
Well, Sean LaTourette, I've read that some critics are saying illegal drivers have turned portions of the Pinelands into the Wild West, that hundreds of riders can congregate at a time. There are, you know, raucous parties. What is your perspective? Is this the case?
In some instances, yes. But I do not want to ascribe what is bad behavior to large swaths of user groups that have as much care for the preservation of our natural resources as conservation organizations. I think that's important because no one of us owns these natural resources, right? Our air, our land, our water, our wetlands, you know, they don't belong to me or to the government. They belong to the people, every single one of the people. And we all have different ways that we enjoy them. What's critical is that we find balance among those different user groups, and that we make very clear to those who would misuse our natural resources that there would be severe penalties for that. So there's a couple of things we're doing in that respect.
Well, I'd like to get to that in just a moment. But does the state have the personnel to manage, to patrol, to keep areas, frankly, clear of the illegal bad apples who are spoiling it for everybody else?
Quite honestly, no, and not because we don't have adequate staffing, but in reaching the most remote areas of the Pinelands is quite the endeavor. We don't have folks that patrol every inch of a state forest. We do take creative approaches to making sure that these resources are used in a way that is appropriate. For example, we use drones to examine areas that have been abused, or even to help find wayward parties that could get lost in these vast forests.
A couple of months ago, Sean, the state closed off portions of a half dozen wildlife management areas to everybody, off-roaders and hikers and birders. What was happening to prompt that action?
Sure. So New Jersey has these majestic areas within some of our WMAs called blue holes. These are former mining areas where you may have had sand and gravel mining back in the day, as they say. And these areas have majestically blue water because of the mineral balance that's present. And they are very attractive to folks to come in and take a dip, except that they can be dangerous. And so we were seeing some overuse of those areas, which are not open for swimming, where folks could drown. And it wasn't just a function of off-road vehicle use so much as it was parties rafting up and having a great time. And you could understand why. I mean, during COVID, our parks and wildlife management areas here in New Jersey, and quite honestly across the country, saw an uptick in use, folks really finding a new way to connect with nature amidst this pandemic. But we got to make sure people do it safely. And there was too much overuse of those areas, and we feared for folks' safety.
We got a comment from Anne who says, nothing soothes my soul more than listening to wind blowing through pine trees. Perhaps give the off-roaders a few square miles to have their fun, but please ban them from the rest of our precious pinelands. What do you think?
Again, I think we have to find that balance. We need to find a way that we make sure folks can access those vehicle roads and those areas that are appropriate for ORV use, and make sure that they're staying out of the areas that aren't. I agree with Anne in that we go to places like the Pinelands, like Wharton State Forest, or even in the northern part of New Jersey, in forests like Worthington, to find that solace, to find that peace, to enjoy those resources. We can do both things at the same time, but it's going to include mapping these areas, deeply engaging the public on what is and is not available for off-road vehicle use, developing and implementing a permit system that requires folks to be apprised by the mapping and obtain a permit if they want to use an ORV. And if they don't, there needs to be penalties. And there have to be penalties that are higher than they are now, so that we have a mechanism for disincentivizing the bad uses that do occur.
So what are the tougher penalties involve?
So right now, there aren't tough penalties. You know, you may have a $50 or a $75 ticket, but there is not what I would call a tiered system where the greater degree of violation carries a higher penalty, including up to confiscation of a vehicle for not being permitted and for being used in abusive ways, so that we are impounding vehicles that are used in the most egregious of ways that that occasionally occurs now, but there needs to be a very clear matrix for what type of activity causes what kind of penalty. And much like driving your car, there's a difference between reckless driving and careless driving, for example, and we need to set up that kind of a system to protect our natural resources.
We talked a few moments ago about the lack of staff to patrol these sensitive areas. Are there any plans to increase the number of staff in an effort to thwart illegal off-roading?
We've been increasing staff over the course of the last year, and we've been lucky that under Governor Murphy's leadership, there's a real keen attention to the needs of our parks, and I expect that that'll continue.
Comment from Jason: I am a preservation advocate, and the state is not doing enough. There is not enough of a plan. One suggestion would be to raise the fine. The amount fined right now is only $75. We did speak about this just a moment ago, but there's not enough of a plan. Let's talk about the plan. And this, of course, that came from Jason. But the plan would produce a new map for trails, correct? Also, the penalties, also a permit system. Public hearings, are they underway at this time?
At this time, what we're doing is working with stakeholders on a draft map for Wharton State Forest. That includes recreational and conservation groups in that effort to balance the critical environmental protections and responsible public access. What we're going to do in the fall, after our peak season of parks visitorship closes, we'll be going out to a more robust public engagement process. One of the criticisms of previous mapping efforts was that the department did not consult with enough folks prior to developing and sharing finalized maps. We don't want to make that mistake, the one that happened 6 years ago. And so we want to engage as broad a group of folks as we can to make sure everyone that has an interest in this issue has an opportunity to share their view and their desires, and then we'll be able to have a final map. And we'll have to go area by area. You can't do this all at once and have one grand map for all of the Pinelands, of course, and we'll need to work with the Pinelands Commission, which is an entity, a governmental entity that is independent of the Department of Environmental Protection. But we'll get there.
So we're talking about, as far as input is concerned, we're including conservationists and we're including the off-roading community. Do you see all sides somehow ending up on the same page?
No, I don't. And that's okay. It's our job to balance the views, whether we're talking about a map for the Pinelands or whether we're talking about the need to reinvent our flood hazard rules to deal with climate change.
I just have to stop you there because we're up against the clock. Any ideas to when a map might be in place? We've got about 5 seconds.
We're going to have a draft this year.
Okay, Sean LaTourette, pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Take care.
Sean LaTourette is New Jersey's Commissioner of Environmental Protection. Up next, Jenny Stolo of Temple University talks about pandemic brain fog. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As the world attempts to move through and away from the pandemic, researchers are noting a lingering effect experienced by many of us, dubbed pandemic brain. Symptoms include fuzzy thinking, distraction, forgetfulness, and low energy, a subtle mental deterioration that set in over the course of 2020 and continues even as more people are vaccinated and we try to recreate something resembling normal life. Experts say the cognitive impairment of pandemic brain is a very real phenomenon. So we're going to dive into this on the Roundup to discuss the causes, therapies to help us cope, and how long does it last? Jenny Stolo is a social and behavioral scientist and assistant professor of instruction at Temple University's College of Public Health. She researches the intersection of infectious diseases and human behavior. Welcome, Jenny.
Hi there. Happy to be here.
Also, lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Well, we are certainly happy to have you with us. Let's begin, Jenny, by illustrating pandemic brain a bit further. Describe some common everyday situations in which we might find ourselves experiencing this.
Sure. So pandemic brain, or pandemic brain fog, is just that. It's a brain fog that we all seem to be walking around in as we're trying to get back to normal, whatever that means. So it's this outcome, as you were saying, of our brains adapting to things like prolonged emotional roller coasters, stress, trauma, isolation, and it can manifest as things like feeling really strange in social situations, or forgetting how to use your subway pass, or just this general kind of feeling that you're forgetting how to return to your, what was your typical routine. So some people may be really tired or fatigued or burned out. You might be more forgetful, unmotivated. You might be overstimulated and understimulated at the same time, or experiencing insomnia, depression, anxiety. Now, I do want to say, if you're listening and thinking, huh, that sounds like me, don't worry. We all have it at this point at varying levels. You're not alone. You're not broken. It's just what we're going through.
Well, I'm right there with you. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm thinking, yes, I've been experiencing that. And it can raise the level of anxiety, especially as we try to move forward again and through this pandemic, which is lingering. We thought this was going to be wrapped up maybe a month or so ago, but no.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the problem is that the changes in your brain are happening because of this prolonged 18 months of emotional processing we've been going through. And it's popping up more so now because of the societal push for everything to, quote unquote, go back to normal. But what we're realizing is that reintegrating into society is hard because we are not the same people we were 18 months ago, and the world isn't the same as it was in 2020. So we're dealing with this stress and trauma and challenges and grief, but we're also trying to get back to this normal that we've been hyper fixating on to get us through the last 18 months. Yeah. So it's really frustrating.
Let's talk about communication. COVID forced us to communicate virtually for the most part, as opposed to in person. Jenny Stolo, do we need to reteach our brains how to do face-to-face interactions? Is it common to be kind of rusty and awkward at this?
Of course it is. Also, even taking it further, the face-to-face with a mask. I know having conversations with friends and family and colleagues, there's that joke, oh, I have to watch my facial expressions now. People have been able to hide their facial expressions for so long. But yes, this back to face-to-face or even in-person activities is going to be hard. The idea of sitting in an in-person meeting and not being able to play with your phone, as maybe some of us have been during other meetings, or students having to focus for a 50-minute class, actually sitting down in a classroom, these are going to be hard. Being able to understand verbal cues, but also body movement and interactions and prolonged conversations without being able to jump off a call really quickly. It's going to be tricky, and you need to have patience with yourself and take it step by step.
Do you recommend that we go on a bit of a screen diet?
Oh, 100%. Right now, it's all about setting yourself up for success. Be kind to yourself, have patience for yourself, as well as others. Baby steps safely. There's still a pandemic happening. And thinking about your body, right? Working out, getting your diet back on track, getting your sleep back on track, and get away from computer screens, your phone, your TV, your many monitors. Step away. Practice mindfulness, recenter, and just reassess what you want your routine to be and how you can do it safely and successfully.
So back to communication for just a moment. Say we have a friend over, you're both vaccinated, and we're still masking because, you know, the Delta variant is out there. But perhaps we're distancing, we remove the masks. You know, as far as communicating face-to-face and it's a little awkward, do we talk about that first and then just try to dive into what we used to do?
Why not address the elephant in the room, right? I think everyone in some level is dealing with this. And so you may as well just say, oh, this is a little awkward, but it's good to see you again. And then go from there. Once again, having patience for others, right? Your bosses, your teachers, your students, your colleagues, your coworkers. Take it with a grain of salt. And just, if it doesn't go great the first time, that's fine. Try again later. You're going to be fine in this baby step version of reintegration.
We're speaking with Jenny Stolo, public health social scientist and professor of social and behavioral sciences at Temple University's School of Public Health. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you'd like to jump into the conversation, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. Jenny, earlier in the conversation, you talked about overstimulation and understimulation, experiencing this at the same time. Get into that a little bit more. It's got to be a very odd sensation.
It is quite an odd sensation. And once again, it's going to depend on who the person is and their comfort level. So for example, going to a grocery store. For some people, going to a grocery store right now might feel very overwhelming. People may still be not wanting to be in the same aisle as someone else, or the idea of going there, going grocery shopping, touching the same objects could be really overwhelming for people. And then for other people, it's just another thing, right? It's, oh, I'll go grab a carton of milk. I don't need a mask. I'm good to go. At the same time, just walking down a street, people are having these different opinions or different comfort levels as well. Whenever you're interacting with someone, you might build up in your mind, I'm going back to hang out with my friends. I'm going to an event I used to love. Maybe it's not as exciting as you remember it being. And maybe you're thinking about all of the other anxiety-driven factors, the distance between you two, how many people are in the restaurant, instead of focusing on the interaction. And so this idea of overstimulation and understimulation, it's happening in these everyday activities that we've never had to think about before.
One hallmark of the pandemic and of, you know, living in some form of isolation has been, you know, boredom. And, you know, we've done shows on boredom before, Jenny. The conclusion from some experts is that a little bit is good and can actually lead to creativity. But what about long spells of boredom? How do we work with this as we start to move into this next somewhat uncertain phase of the pandemic, where we've got a real mix of things going on? Maybe partway back to work, partway back to seeing people in person, and yet we're just kind of in this midway zone. What are your suggestions?
That's a great question. I think most of us look back to the beginning of lockdown, the pandemic, and remember all of us binging the same Netflix shows and being in pajamas and talking about work from home life. But now we're really moving into 18 months. It's not something to joke about anymore. It's really been 18 months for some people of deep isolation, and if not more so, moving into the second wave, right? Or fourth wave or fifth wave, however you want to look at it. Isolation and boredom are really tricky because there's this itty bitty bit of it where you can practice mindfulness and you can think about, what can I do with my time, with my space, with this opportunity? But then it does become much deeper. And so keep checking in on your friends and family. Just because you maybe are not bored doesn't mean they're not. Just because you can get vaccinated, wear a mask, go back into society, maybe they can't, right? And so my biggest concern is actually that we're seeing less of a togetherness than we had in the beginning of the pandemic,
really?
And even more isolation in some ways.
Well, we've got a tweet from Lisa who says, I dread getting in the car because I now find it so boring. I can hardly tolerate having to drive 20 minutes to work.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great example of all of these small parts of our routine, even waking up, showering, getting fully dressed, getting in your car, doing your commute. That seems preposterous to a lot of people right now because they've just rolled out of bed and hopped on Zoom. And so it's really forcing us to re-examine all of these parts of our daily lives.
Yeah. What do you suggest for a car ride that might be intimidating? As, again, you can't really practice mindfulness, as I understand it, while you're trying to focus on driving, or perhaps you can to an extent, but I'm thinking audiobooks or turning on the radio music.
Exactly. So audiobooks. Some people have picked up on hobbies, so letting that be an opportunity to study up on your type of hobby or type of activity that you like to do, listening to the radio, trying something new, anything you can do to keep your brain engaged in that task and keeping it different, right? We have been stuck in monotony for so long that even just saying, every day this week I'm going to try a new radio station, that's sounds ridiculous, but actually is, for your brain, excitement enough to keep you motivated to get into that car and go through that commute.
We've got a tweet from Mac who says, I used to be really outgoing, but feel pretty antisocial the past few months. Totally different than I used to be. My question is, will I go back to my normal self soon? How long? Help. I'm sure a lot of people are feeling the same way, especially, again, since, you know, we felt perhaps in the spring, early summer, we were starting to come out of this. And now with the Delta variant, especially, and an increase in cases in certain parts of the country, we're plunged back into uncertainty again.
Right. And you are not alone. I think a lot of people are in that position. This is not for forever. It's just take a second and think about, why are you being antisocial? Is it because you're out of practice? Is it because maybe you feel that the activities you used to do might not be fun anymore? Are you nervous about seeming foolish or out of touch? Is it that anxiety is stopping you from doing it? Is it that you'd prefer to do something else? And the answer might be a million things, but the most important thing to do right now is try safely, of course, but try baby steps. Go for a walk. Pick up a phone and call someone instead of just texting. Go for a half hour coffee date with someone, right? Start small and try not, I know it sounds too good to be true, but try not to get frustrated with yourself. Be kind to yourself. We have gone through collective trauma of a global pandemic. You do not need to bounce back and you do not need to be that person you were. Maybe you'll be an even better person now.
Well, Matt, he spoke of feeling normal. I mean, will the new normal be like the old normal was? What can we expect?
I think we need to see how things go. Everyone's normal was different, right? For some people, working from home was normal. And so they don't feel the pandemic changed their lives so much. Other people are extreme extroverts who were visiting people, traveling the world, really integrated into society, kind of spontaneous people. And this has really grounded them. I think normal is going to be different. We don't go backwards. That's just how it works. So think about what parts of normal you really want and see if that's something that you can have moving forward.
And important to observe, Jenny Stolo, that while symptoms of pandemic brain can mimic, you know, early signs of dementia, experts say pandemic brain should eventually clear up once we resume the lives that we want to have that perhaps more closely resemble pre-pandemic life. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that's exactly right. This is baby steps, training wheels, right? You get off the bike, you get back on, it takes some time to adjust. Also, it's not just your bubble that has to adjust to allow you to get back to normal, which is frustrating, right? We're counting on us, our neighbors, our cities, our states, our everyone to have to align for normalcy to actually occur. So have patience. It's going to take some time to wrangle all of the cats.
An article in the Washington Post looked at the decade following the 1918 flu pandemic, the Roaring Twenties. As Post reporter Marlene Simons put it, it was an age striking in its excesses. Do you see that for us when we're finally out of this, maybe like the Roaring 2020s?
Yes, I think we're already starting to see that, right? How many people are rushing to travel again or go to music festivals or just ignore everything that has been happening? I do think that everyone wants to get back to normal. And for those who are also struggling with pandemic brain, they might say, okay, I'm just going to double down until it feels normal. Right? Just go into hyperdrive and push it until it feels like what my life was like. So it's very possible. I expect a lot of weirdness in the months to come with all of the waves of COVID. Yeah. But I do think that humans are durable. We adapt and we will be just fine.
Another listener on Twitter says, I went to a party when we were told it was okay for vaccinated people to get together without masks. I found I was really aware of people's breathing and constantly backing away from the feel of the breath of people talking to me. Felt creepy, but Jenny Stolo, probably fairly normal for pandemic brain?
Yes, that is a great example of how aware we've become. Because we've had this training, right? Listening to media, watching things, being told to be cautious. Like I said, the distance between people, how people breathe. I think nowadays if someone coughs, everyone freaks out a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Or people who have allergies. Allergies give people a lot of anxiety because they're like, I hope it's not COVID, or I hope people don't think I have COVID. So yes, that is a great example of pandemic brain. And it's something that, as someone who studies infectious diseases, I say, keep doing that. It's always good to know if people are coughing or breathing funny, but you're definitely not alone in that.
Well, at the end of the day, your advice, be kind to yourself, is what we'll take with us. Jenny Stolo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jenny Stolo is a public health social scientist and professor of social and behavioral sciences at Temple University School of Public Health. And to round out the hour, we'll talk about the mystery illness which was hitting songbirds. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It has been a tough summer for songbirds. A few months ago, numerous species across the mid-Atlantic began to show symptoms of a deadly illness: swollen, crusty eyes, blindness, disorientation, stumbling, dizziness, twitching. Bird lovers were advised to empty and clean feeders and bird baths and to avoid handling ill songbirds. Now there are reports that the number of new cases is leveling off and declining, even as researchers still work to identify the disorder. At least one lab is theorizing the outbreak could be related to the emergence of the brood 10 cicadas earlier this year. We're going to discuss the latest on this mysterious ailment and take your calls and comments at 888-477-9499. Again, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Chris Strube joins us for the remainder of the hour. He is Director of Wildlife Rehabilitation at the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, there are those reports that there are thankfully fewer cases of songbirds falling ill. Is this reflected in what you're seeing at the Schuylkill Center?
Yes, it's been interesting for us. We at the Schuylkill Center have not seen a lot of these cases during the summer. We've been really vigilant about it, but we've been pretty lucky to not see a lot of cases. So our numbers haven't really changed, but I do know that other facilities in the region have been seeing declining numbers, which is really great news.
So what do you think of this working theory from the Cornell Wildlife Health Lab that the illness could be related to the emergence of the brood 10 cicada this year? According to Cornell, areas where the illness has been reported match areas where the cicadas emerged, you know, leading some researchers to think that maybe ingesting the insects might have been toxic to the birds. Have you heard much about that?
Yeah, I think that's been a theory since this started happening. I'm always a little cautious until we have something from the lab, something a little bit more conclusive. Personally, of assigning it to the cicadas. But I've always found it interesting that in our direct area around the Schuylkill Center, we haven't seen a lot of cicadas. We also haven't seen a lot of cases, so that kind of matches up. That's made me a little bit suspicious that it may be related to cicadas. But we're still going to be, you know, watching out just in case it's something else.
Sure.
We don't want to let our guards down and then find out, you know, that it was something other than the cicadas.
Well, one more question in association with the cicadas. One theory is that people were spraying the cicadas with pesticides as the insects emerged, and then birds were ingesting the bugs and getting sick. What effects do pesticides have on birds, Chris?
Pesticides can have a lot of wide-ranging effects, but we do often see neurological symptoms. So the twitching, the disorientation that's described with this illness can also cause digestive issues where the birds can't process the food that they're ingesting correctly, and things like that. So it can cause a lot of systemic issues, pesticides can.
And as far as the mystery illness is concerned, which species have been most commonly affected? What is your understanding?
We've seen blue jays, grackles, starlings, robins, and cardinals seem to be the most commonly impacted species, but others have been reported as well. It's mostly those species, though.
And what else are affected birds being tested for with this illness?
We're looking for viral and bacterial agents. That's why that we advise taking down feeders in case it was something infectious. So if it is pesticide based, then it's probably not communicable, which is a good thing in some ways. But if it is a bacterial agent or viral or even fungal, then that could be something that's transmissible between birds, which would be, you know, a lot more of an issue.
The number to call, 888-477-9499. Allison has called in this question. What connection, if any, does the current disease have with one about 25 years ago that caused severe conjunctivitis in house finches? Their populations were decimated by that disease, and even now, I rarely see them around my house. I stopped feeding birds then and never began again. Do you have any information on that? 25 years ago is quite a span of time, but does this stick with you?
It sounds like finch conjunctivitis, which is a disease that we see all the time. We get cases in really regularly of this illness. It's a viral illness. It causes crustiness in the eyes. It primarily affects finches. And occasionally we'll see larger outbreaks of the illness. And when that does happen, we have the same advice. You know, take down your feeders at least until the outbreak has passed. I don't know whether this current disease is connected, again, until we get some kind of conclusive results from the testing. I wouldn't want to say one way or the other. But we have received cases of finch conjunctivitis over the summer that have responded to the usual treatment that we do for it, whereas this mystery disease does not seem to be responding to those types of treatments.
How do you treat the conjunctivitis? Just curious.
We have a couple of medications that we can use and eye drops basically to keep them more comfortable. And it's a really long course of treatment for finch conjunctivitis. It takes at least 21 days of a medication. Even when the eye illness clears up, we keep them on that medication for the full 21 days just to be sure that nothing's left in the system before we can start considering them for release.
So back to the mystery illness, there are, you know, as you mentioned, a number of measures the state wants us to take to discourage the spread of this illness, including, you know, discontinue with the bird feeders. This is really hard for some people to do, Chris, because, there's a sense that if we stop feeding birds, they will suffer. Is that the case?
So, no, it's not the case. I really understand that feeling. You know, it can feel like, well, you're providing all this food for them, and what happens when that goes away? But spring and summer are really the best time to be removing feeders because there are a lot of native food sources for these birds. And in fact, a lot of songbird species feed their young almost exclusively on insects. And so at this time of year, they're going to be relying really heavily on wild insects, not something that can be provided in a bird feeder. So they're really not suffering. There are a lot of food sources out there for them. And one thing that can be great if you can't put a feeder up, you know, if we're still recommending to leave them down. Providing native plants is huge for the birds, even if it's just potted plants on your porch. It attracts the insects that they eat. So there are some native plants that can also provide direct food sources. So that's a way to provide for them a little bit in an area where, you know, you might be concerned there's a little bit less green space without having those feeders out.
So you're not suggesting that people scatter feed on the ground?
No, we also don't recommend doing that. Anything that causes the birds to congregate unnaturally close to each other can be an area of disease spread. So even if the ground is not as likely to hold on to contaminants as something like a bird feeder, the birds are still going to be clustering together. They can still pass any infectious agents between one another. So we don't recommend scatter feeding.
Got it. Okay, bird baths. You know, they can be a lot of fun when you fill them up and you watch, you know, birds kind of play around in them, maybe even frolic in them. But there again, you know, the state is saying just, you know, empty them out, don't use them. Are bird baths something that are useful to birds in the first place?
Yes, they definitely can be, especially on hot days. Again, they have plenty of ways to get water that aren't in bird baths. You know, but bird baths can be a useful place to provide clean water in situations where we're not dealing with a concern about infectious diseases. But again, it's a place where they are congregating unnaturally close to each other. And then if they're not cleaned out regularly, they can be a real problem for disease spread.
Okay, so feeders, bird baths, don't use them. What's the best way to clean them?
Bleach solution, 10% bleach solution. You know, scrub them out with soap and water, soak them in bleach, rinse them off really well, and let them dry thoroughly. And then when it is safe to put them back out, you know, pop them right back outside.
Okay. So if we were to come across a dead or injured bird, how do you handle it?
So current recommendation is to take a plastic bag and invert it over your hand like a glove, pick the bird up, seal the bag up, and then contact, if you go on the Pennsylvania Game Commission website or the Wildlife Futures Program website, there are links to have the bird sent out for testing for the illness. If you find a living bird that is in distress, the best thing to do is reach out right away to your nearest wildlife rehabilitation center and the Schuylkill Center Wildlife Clinic. We have a 24-hour hotline, and even if you're not in our direct area, we're always happy to answer calls like that and provide some guidance and figure out how to get the bird help.
All right, and back to the bird that might be dead. I guess guessing it's important to keep pets away.
Yes, definitely. That's always the case. Even if it's possibly not this mystery illness or it's another type of deceased wild animal, or even a living animal who's in distress, always best to keep pets away.
Sure. So Chris Strube, interestingly, hummingbirds seem to be unaffected by this mystery illness, at least according to what I've seen in published reports. Is that your understanding? And if they are unaffected, should we take their feeders down?
Yep. So it seems like hummingbirds are not affected by this disease, as far as I've seen. And we think that it's fine to leave the hummingbird feeders up for now. Again, it's something we're watching really closely, but we're not recommending taking down hummingbird feeders at this time. Of course, you still want to clean them regularly. Make sure that the sugar water is changed out every day. They can harbor bacteria if they're left uncleaned, which can be a problem in other ways for the hummingbirds. But as far as the mystery illness, we're not recommending taking them down.
So as cases of this illness taper off, Chris, are you concerned it might pose a long-term threat to the songbird population?
It is a concern. We just don't know what's going to happen in the fall. Migration season's right around the corner, so a lot of these young birds, the disease seems mostly to be impacting fledglings, which are young birds who have left the nest, but they're not full adults yet, sort of teenagers of the bird world. A lot of those young birds are going to be making their first long-distance migrations in the fall, starting in just a couple weeks for some species and then lasting through October. And migration is really taxing on them. Yeah. So if this is some kind of infectious agent that may still be living inside the bird, their immune systems can be somewhat compromised by the stresses of migration. So I'll be interested to see if we see any kind of reemergence of this disease during migration, with these birds getting sick just because of those stresses. And then again, with migration, they are moving to different areas. So, you know, if it is something that's infectious, we could see it spread to new populations. But my hope is that with cases dropping off, you know, honestly, I hope that it's related to the cicadas, because that means that we should sort of naturally see this disease pass and not crop up again.
How can we help birds make it through migration season safely?
The best thing you can do really is to bird safe, bird proof your windows. Window strikes are a huge, huge problem for birds all year round, but especially during migration season. They don't see glass as a solid surface. They think they can fly through it. So they'll fly into windows at high speeds. It's mostly a problem with really tall buildings, but even residential buildings can be a problem. So there are all kinds of ways that you can make your windows safe for birds. You can put up decals, stickers, keep your blinds closed, even shutting off the lights when it starts to get dark. A lot of birds migrate overnight. Shutting off the lights can help keep them from getting disoriented and make sure that they can migrate safely. Then just avoiding using pesticides, planting native plants that they can use for resources. Those are also helpful things.
What are some other common threats to birds?
Pets, people's pets are a big one. Outdoor cats do kill a lot of birds. We see that all the time. And then just habitat loss is a huge problem for them. So, you know, the green spaces that they would use for shelter and to find food being removed is pretty harmful to them, unfortunately.
So can a homeowner make a difference? I know we've had environmental advocates on before who have said, you know, leave a portion of your lawn wild, natural, which is not always easy to do, because people look at you and they kind of go, what are you doing here? You know, even though we know what it is and we try to explain it. But is this an answer, in your opinion?
Yes, that's a huge help, not just for birds, but for all kinds of wild animals. And really, insects form the backbone of a lot of ecosystems. And that's really a lot of what you're doing when you're leaving part of your lawn wild. Or again, even if you're doing plantings, working with native plants, you know, with landscapers who will work with native plants with you, is you're providing resources for those insects that then sort of go up the food chain, feed the birds, feed various mammal species and reptiles. And then, you know, of course, anything that's fruiting or flowering plants for pollinators like hummingbirds, leaving those spaces wild is a huge help to a lot of animals, including the songbirds.
Okay, you've given us some good talking points on that. Thank you, Chris. So just briefly before we wrap up, let's talk about the rehab work that you do at the Schuylkill Center. Which species are you working with right now? What are you seeing coming in?
We are still seeing a lot of young birds. We're actually waiting on goldfinches. Goldfinches are some of the last birds in our area to nest, so we'll probably be seeing their babies come in any day, and still getting a lot of robin, fledglings, cardinals, things like that. We've also started seeing baby squirrels, squirrels breed twice a year, once in the spring and then once again in the fall. So we're getting our round two of baby squirrels, which is they're a lot of work, but we really love them, and we love seeing them grow up and eventually return to the wild. So that's a lot of what we're seeing right now.
Why do you do what you do?
I just, you know, I love animals, and more than that, wildlife face so many challenges in more urban environments with, you know, human habitation. They face all kinds of threats. Most of the animals that we see at the center are there because of human-caused issues, whether directly or indirectly. So I'm just trying to make any difference that I can with those animals and returning as many as possible back into the wild, fixing a little bit of the damage that these human interactions have caused.
Chris Trube, thank you so much. Chris is Director of Wildlife Rehabilitation at the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us on the Regional Roundup. Be well.